Hello. It's Saturday the 25th of April, and I'm Rob Watson, and I'm here at Jubilee Square with a long-time collaborator. Does that sound the right word? John Coster.
Hi, Rob. You okay? I had about 30 different like job titles and names and functions appear in my head then, and none of them seem to be relevant, so we'll do collaborator. We'll go with that.
I'm just going to check my levels and make sure that
I've got the date right.
There we go. That's did I get the date right?
You got the date right. 25th.
So what's going on today?
Well, it's good to be here, isn't it? It's the Old Town Festival here on Jubilee Square, but also in three locations. So we've got quite a big activation point all around the cathedral and the places there, you know, out on the street in the Guildhall, and then we've got Jubilee Square where we've got lots of performances. People probably can hear music in the background. Bill playing his accordion. Got a fantastic boat. Where did that boat come from? Makes you want to have a boat, doesn't it? And lots of activity. I think the Vikings are going to do a demonstration as well. And then down at Jury Wall, there's some archaeology stuff. And for me, the great thing about supporting Professor Sarah Scott at the Heritage Hub at the University of Leicester with this event is the fact that it's making heritage accessible. You can look around you now and it's reflective of the community of Leicester. There's lots of family learning and activities and stuff, and it's come down and find out about things maybe from the past with Leicester that they might not necessarily know about, you know, Romans 2,000 years ago or Saxons, or I think there's a regiment of foot round there as well from the English Civil War, which obviously relates quite nicely to some of the bullet holes you can still find around Leicester. So yeah, it's good. And of course the sun's shining, which is amazing.
I'm just hoping that the Vikings kind of demonstrate murder and pillage.
Well, it looks like legalised violence to me. Of course, if it was football hooliganism, we'd have the police here. But you know, because it's the Vikings, but they've all got a sword and a shield, they seem to get away with it. It's quite good. I did say to a guy I know round at the King Richard III Centre, they with a great big spike standing outside, and I said, "Do you need a licence for that, mate?" And he turned around and just burst out laughing because I'd asked him. And he said, yes, it's in my pocket, actually, so he does have a licence for it.
So what makes heritage accessible, and should heritage be accessible?
Oh, that's a good question. What makes heritage accessible? The fact that it's zero cost, I think, and it means that you're able to engage in it in a way that's in your terms, which means that it's not necessarily your language. It's not about having everything translated into your language, which might not be necessarily a popular way of coming at it. But I think it's more about, well, look, you know, this is the language of the day. And these things might not necessarily be politically correct or acceptable now, but that's how things were in the past. So rather than trying to, you know, whether it's like, you know, whitewash it or tinker with it or make it woke, as some people would say, at the end of the day, if this is what we did back there, I mean, child soldiers is one of those things I find is quite cross-cutting with conflict memory across the world. Is, you know, we think it's a modern an aberration, but in fact it's always been there. A bit like child labour, isn't it? You know, like people in Mary Poppins, the kids going up chimneys, but suddenly it's like, well, we forget about the fact that we, you know, 120 years ago, as a 9-year-old, you were perfectly eligible to go up a chimney and not go to school. So we talk about heritage from the point of view of us being very noble, maybe, having quite slightly a certain view of it, you know, like magnanimous, you know, whereas in fact when you're quite magnanimous about it and then look at the rest of the world, you think to yourself, well, you know, these things that are still going on in certain places of the world, they were perfectly acceptable here 100 years ago. That doesn't make us more civilised. It's more about, you know, certain laws and labour laws and things like that. And it's only when you come to an event like this that can you have those kind of conversations quite openly, rather than, you know, on a YouTube channel or listening to a podcast or listening to someone's Twitter feed where they're quite angry and invoking, you know, immigrants on boats. Well, in fact, we're standing here 2,000 years of Leicester where immigration and migration and all those kind of things, slave labour were a thing, you know.
I wonder if some of the children wander about with balloons and party hats and things would benefit from a workhouse experience.
You mentioned Gen Z then, didn't you? You're talking about, yeah, young people. It's like anything though, isn't it? You go into schools and, you know, I've worked in a lot of schools with Tina Barton, and you know, we've been into various colleges, haven't we, with Sarah Rastall and stuff like that, Crown Hills. And you look at the quality of the experience they're having, not the quality of the teacher, not the quality of the curriculum, but the quality of the experience that they're having. And that experience is working with others that wouldn't normally be in an educational setting. Just to ask you, but why do you think that happened? have you seen this? This is an alternative. I remember working in that college and it was amazing, wasn't it? We went in and totally held my hand. I mean, I was completely guilty. We were working with these 14, 15-year-old South Asian girls. There was about nine of them. And I went in there thinking we were going to be talking about Taylor Swift and makeup and Bollywood and all that sort of stuff.
And your hopes were dashed.
And my hopes were dashed that I could confess to being a Swiftie. And they went straight for, was it child marriage, trafficking, Palestine, you know, all that kind of, they went straight into the teachers, and the teachers were absolutely gobsmacked because the teachers are teaching them subjects, they weren't having a conversation with them about the world around them. And of course at 14, 15 through social media, they are completely engaged with what's going on in the world, but no adult necessarily to talk to them about it.
There was an interesting conversation I had the other day about TikTok, and actually somebody, the point that the person I was talking to made was that we really do need to hang on. Not everything can be TikTok, TikTokified.
Yeah. TikTokable.
Yeah, and so what? You know, what's the benefit of the hard slog of reading about something, extended criticism? You know, that investigation into something, the multiple layers of things, rather than just the hey, let's just do a dance for a few minutes and make something entertaining.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we live in a very kind of fast, superficial world where it's more about, you know, top level headlines, that kind of stuff. And what we don't really get anybody to understand, so certainly the work I'm doing in Nigeria with S24 Television, is more about context, you know, and that context can come from listening to a podcast or reading a book or watching a documentary or having a conversation with someone with lived experience. I'm not saying to you it has to be in school education and something that you have to do in a certain way. It's more about just take the time to find out a little bit more. Whichever way your investigation into your context comes, then just do it that way. It doesn't have to be the other way around. You know?
What are you off to see shortly?
Well, I'm off to see... Well, I don't know. I'd like to go and see the ladies in the Guildhall from the Family History Society. Yep. And I think they've got quite a lot of stuff that's going on, which will be quite good. You know, as always with family history, you're talking about people that are doing things a certain way. I think it's good to see like a Viking demonstration, and the Archaeological Society as well is talking about things that have been here that can be found probably by you digging it up in your garden. And I think it's that, not the top level stuff about famous people or famous generals and stuff, but more about, you know, my conflict memory things about the experience of ordinary people, the people that don't get mentioned because they don't win awards or get medals. Or weren't considered brave enough at that particular time. And also the people that, you know, probably wrote letters home, and unless the family kept that letter, it's never no interest to the records office or the museum. You know, it's treated more like house clearance, you know what I mean? It's yours, but how would you get the local social history museum, if it's open, to be interested in taking it? Well, you won't, because they're just not interested, because they're not famous enough. So.
Cool. Let's catch up again soon.
Nice one. Thanks a lot, Rob.
Yeah. My name's Brun. I'm a trader, and I deal in trading goods and exploration and navigation. But I also do a bit of research into various Viking myths and things.
Oh, well, we're very interested in some of your myths that you could tell us.
Yeah, depends what you want to know.
Do you have any that relate to Leicester at all?
Not particularly. Funnily enough, Leicester... There's not a lot of archaeological evidence around Leicester, despite the fact it was one of the big Viking centres. There's not been much found in or around Leicester. The Viking myths weren't really about corporeal places like on Earth. They were more mythology, like, for instance, the gods all lived in Asgard, where Odin, Thor, Freya, Loki, they would have lived up in the heavens. And then below that, you've got Midgard, where humans lived. And below that, you've got Hela, where you went to hell.
Oh, right.
And then you also had Valhalla, where all of Viking warriors who died in battle went. And that was basically like a big mead hall where they just got drunk and ate a lot and chased the women around a lot. So that was their reward for dying in battle in Valhalla. So all the Vikings, that's why they were so fierce in battle, because they were quite happy dying.
Right.
They were a bit like the Japanese kamikaze. They thought it was good dying because they went to Valhalla, because it was nicer up there.
Like the suicide bombers.
Yeah, basically, well, sort of. They weren't quite that bad, but they didn't have any fear, real fear of dying, because if they died in battle, that's what they wanted to do.
And they were so certain that this was correct.
Oh, yes, yes. Because the Vikings weren't actually a race of people. They were a culture from Sweden, Denmark, Norway, places like that. And they all had more or less the same values. They could speak the same sort of language. And they had a lot of the same mythology.
Do you know any more
mythology? Oh, God, you could go for hours and hours and hours. You had the Midgard serpent, who was the son of Loki, who was a mischievous god, a bit evil. He was always trying to get one of her on Thor. And the Midgard serpent was that big. It surrounded Midgard, and it circled Midgard, and caused chaos, wars, famine, all sorts of trouble. And Thor used to come down from Asgard on his chariot, drawn by two huge horned goats, and his hammer, Mjolnir, and he used to fight the Midgard serpent. And he's defeated him, because we've not died yet. And Viking mythology has it that if he doesn't defeat the serpent, you'll have what's called, and I've forgotten the name of it. No, it's got the end of the world, basically. So Thor's stopping the end of the world. But there's all sorts. I mean, Odin was one-eyed. He was the father god. He sat on his throne, and he was one-eyed because he actually took his eye out and gave it to a wisdom tree, and to gain all the wisdom of the world. So he became the all-wise, all-father. He also had two ravens, Huggin and Munin. Used to sit on his shoulders, and he used to send those around the world to find out things. So if you ever see two ravens watching you, you got to be careful, because Odin's got his eye on you, literally. But there's all sorts of different, I mean, Odin's horse, Sleipnir, had eight legs and could move between worlds, basically. But there are literally thousands of different mythology. Norse mythology, I can't think of any more off the top of my head, but yeah, it's that sort of thing.
And are these stories still told or not?
The problems with the Vikings is they've never written language, which makes it really awkward for us as a reenactment group, because we try and base everything on reality. The only thing they really had was runes, which were meanings and names.
Yeah.
But they did have what's called the Icelandic sagas, which, because they sat around the fires at night, they never really much else to do apart from the obvious. They tell long stories, so a lot of it was passed down word of mouth, and some of the stories are sort of a bit but some of it was actually written down. The medieval monks wrote down a lot about the Vikings, because they didn't really like the Vikings, because they got killed by them. They wrote a lot of stuff that wasn't very nice about the Vikings. But the Icelanders, who speak as near to Norse as you're ever going to get, they still have societies who pass down the sagas. And some of the sagas, I mean, there's like Beowulf, who fights a dragon. They can go on for 5, 6, 7 days. They go on and on and on. I sat and read one once. I got about half an hour into it, thought, okay, he killed the dragon at the end, that was it. I wasn't really interested in watching anything else.
So what interests you in
doing this? I started doing this because I was retiring and wanted something to do. And I've always been interested in mythology. Even when I was younger, I used to read about Aztecs and Egyptians. And I've always been a bit fascinated by the Vikings. And I looked these guys up and went along on the Wednesday night where we meet at St Mary's Hall in Braunston. So if anybody wants to come and join us, please do. We're always looking for new members. You don't have to be a combatee. You can do all sorts of things.
How do people get in touch with you?
We have a website, which is the Vikings of Middle England, at www.vikingsof.me, at Vikings Leicester. But if you just put Vikings of Middle England in Google, it'll show us. They show you what we do, where we've been. We do events like this. We are a historical reenactment, so we try and base everything on archaeological finds and what is actually real. Unlike some, they stretch the truth a little bit. The Saw Vikings would go around with horns on their helmets, which they didn't do.
No, no.
Just, you know, cows over there.
Thank you ever so much.
That's
okay. What's your name and how have you been finding the festival so far?
My name is Miriam and it's been a lovely day. We decided to come here because we wanted to have a bit different Saturday and the weather is gorgeous. And it's been very nice to be here. Only one I'm missing here is the ice cream vans.
Hi, would you like to tell me your name and any myths or legends or stories that you want to share with us today?
So we are Black Annis Morris, all the way from Leicester, and our myth or story we'd like to share is a Leicester story about Black Annis the witch, of course.
Yes, Black Annis lived in the Dane Hills of Leicester. She lived in a cave. And she loved little children.
That's Weston Park to anybody that doesn't know.
And yeah, she wasn't a very nice person. She did like children a lot, but she did like to suck out their blood with her slack lips and crunch up their bones with her sharp teeth and leave their skins out to dry.
Now, some people might also know Newark Houses in Leicester. And in fact, that's a place you might not want to hang out at certain times of day because it's where Black Annis lurked to carry out her snatch and grab and drag children away to her cave. And then it is said, there is hope, you might think, oh no, poor children, how can there be any children left in Leicester with Black Annis around? In fact, she only came out in winter, and when the church bells struck bong midnight, Black Annis was banished back underground.
And that is the legend of Black Annis told by Sandy and Jam.
Thank you so much for that story, guys. Do you want to share what you've been up to today and how you're enjoying the festival so far?
Yeah, we had an absolute blast so far. It's not over for us yet because as one of the Morris sides that are dancing at Old Town Festival, we've danced on Jubilee Square. We're here at Drury Wall, which is a fantastic historical place to go with our historical story. And now we're very soon back actually inside Leicester Cathedral, which is fantastic for them to allow people to dance in there. We'll be there with Leicester Morris very, very soon. So we're looking forward to the rest of the day.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, guys.
Okay, what's your name and do you have any myths or legends that you'd like to share?
So, my name is Simon Jones. I'm the commanding officer of Lord Grey's Regiment. And myths and legends of the Civil War period. Well, it doesn't matter where you go in this country, apparently the King or Cromwell has slept there, at there or been there. So it's amazing. There must have been a lot of people. So that's probably the best myth of the Civil War, is that those two was everywhere.
And how have you been enjoying the festival so far?
It's been absolutely fantastic, been really, really busy. We've been busy from about 11 o'clock, so an hour before it officially started. And we haven't stopped yet, so the sun's out and it's all good.
Thank you so much.
Hello. Hello. My name's Joan. I'm 80 years old. And I've had quite a varied life. I was born in the south of South Wales, just after the war. That's where my family had gone through the war. And then we went back to London. And it was a nice place, very friendly. And then all of a sudden, in like the 50s and 60s, there was sort of more, lots of intake of different cultures. So the cultures was quite different. And so then there was a lot of people, one still talking Cockney rhyming, like up in the wooden stairs, or go up the apples and pears, and that sort of thing. So it was, although I wasn't really into all that sort of thing when I was younger, but you can still see there's lots of traditions now that carry on. You know, we saw there's been some good programs about what happened like during the war and after the war and different cultures that came in. I mean, just up the road from where I used to live, there used to be lots of Jewish people, and they had their own theatre, and then gradually they moved away from the East End, and they sort of went in, moved away different places, and then we had lots of Bangladeshi people came in, and they had their traditions, of course, and all their, you see all these different foods in the markets. So it's quite a cosmopolitan place. And then we moved from there, must have been in the 90s. So we've been up in Leicester about 25 years now. And again, I was quite surprised at how nice and friendly the people were. And, you know, you just have to get on with people, because I think you have to accept people as they are. If they're like nice and friendly to you, as long as you smile, I think that's the thing to do, isn't it? So I hope this is what you're looking for.
Yes, it's fine. Have you picked up stories from all the different cultures that you talked about?
Not really. I can remember these, like the Cockney traditions, where there was people in the market used to pull the barrows through, and they were called costermongers. And with having the name of Costa, I think originally my husband's family must have been like in the markets, because a Costa is a French word for apple, so that sort of thing. And there's lots of traditions. They're nice to hear about, and they're not really dying out, because lots of people try to keep them alive, which I think you should do. Because now there's so much on the TV and what have you. You don't sort of see everyday life like you used to. I mean, I can remember the going down in the Whitechapel Road. It used to be called... it was a Saturday market, and they'd all come out, all the stalls would come out on a Saturday, and they'd all different fruits and vegetables. And then, as you say, as the time got on and that culture went, you'd got... There was not so many bagel shops then. That was more sort of the Asian stuff, you know. But It's quite good, because it's interesting. It keeps you going out and looking at different things. Anyway, I hope that's enough for you.
Thank you very much.
What's your name, and how have you been finding the festival so far?
My name's Henry, and I have been really enjoying it. There's been loads of people and a non-stop crowd so far.
Has there been anything in particular that you've enjoyed? Have you seen any of the other stalls?
I went in, and there was loads of stalls and loads of cool stuff.
What's your name, and have you heard any myths or legends that you would like to talk about?
My name's Elaine, and I work on the Leicester City Library's children's book bus. Myths and legends, we've got loads of books that kind of support that, so all different sorts of things from all over the world. So, and lots of stories that we read to children, all to do with, well, not just myths and legends, but that's a section that we have in libraries. So.
And how are you enjoying the festival?
Oh, it's lovely. I mean, the weather's beautiful, and we've had lots of people through to come and see our book bus, so, and talk about library services, so we're really enjoying it.
Thank you.
Oh, there's a little dragon there.
That was great, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Like, what is that?
It's a dragon.
No, but like, what is it made of? Is it?
I'm so sorry. The lady was like to us. Excuse me. Do you know where the dragon's gonna be? And it just came up behind.
That's so fair.
Follow it all the way
around. What's your name, and do you know any myths and legends?
Hi, my name's Jackie, and I always feel sorry for the dragon. He always seems to be the bad guy. I don't know why. Because he breathes fire. You can have him in your home, you know, and you can heat your house up. It won't cost you a penny. It's just as long as you feed him. I've no idea what, but you can feed him. He'll warm your house up for you. Don't you?
And how are you enjoying the festival, Jackie?
I'm enjoying it. I've got a performance at 3:15. So while I'm here, I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it. And I love the sunshine as well. So, yeah, it's very good. Very atmospheric. Yeah. Come down and join us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Hello, I'm Sally Varnum. I'm the Creative Health and Heritage Manager at Leicester's Hospital. So we're based at Glenfield Hospital. And we have the Creative Health and Heritage Centre there. And today we are making some quack medicine called... It's based on Thomas Holloway's ointment. Thomas Holloway was a 19th century person who made a lot of money out of making an ointment which was made from various things, including animal fat, paraffin, and various herbs and spices. And he marketed this as a cure-all. He told people that it could... cure anything from a headache to a broken leg to a bout of gout, but of course that was a load of nonsense. He made a lot of money out of it, but it was a great sort of marketing campaign. And one of the things that he tried to do was to get Charles Dickens to include the ointment in one of his books, and Charles Dickens, being a very clever man, of course refused because he could tell that it was a load of nonsense. So we're making some quack ointment today. We're using some coconut oil and some herbs and spices that are really nice for your skin to engage people with what we're doing and with the medical collection at Leicester's Hospitals.
Hello.
Hello. So my name's Cale. I'm Jarl of Tearslith, which is our Viking war band. And I'm going to talk about some Viking myths and legends and what we know about them. So the thing with the Viking myths and legends is they were written down far after the Viking age, so usually in the sort of mid-1200s. Many of the works that survive come from Iceland, and they're written really as a record of the different oral stories and traditions. So with that in mind, you can't always tell, you know, what's kind of remembered correctly, what's been kind of bent in a kind of a modern sense for that contemporary period, and also what's been sort of changed by you know, the introduction of Christianity for the last sort of 200 or 300 years in Iceland. So with all that kind of stuff in mind, what we do know about the Viking myths are from those texts. And so we know about the kind of some of the different gods. We know that Odin is seen as the sort of a chief god, the Allfather. We know about Thor and Freya and Frigg, and some minor gods as well that pop up in different sort of poems and the what are called lays, which are like a kind of epic poem. For example, Thor, we probably know a lot more about these days because he's really famous being in the different Marvel superhero universe, and Loki. So in the sagas, it's not always clear like what Loki's relationship is, whether he's a blood brother to Odin or is the son of Odin. All we do know is he's a naughty boy and does lots of very funny things with the gods, but he always also tries to help them get out of it, even if he caused the trouble. So one of the more funny stories is Thor's hammer goes missing, and of course Loki, being the trickster he is, Thor blames him straight away. He thinks, Thor, Loki, you've stolen my hammer, Mjolnir, where is it? And you know, he threatens to beat him up and kill him and things like that unless he returns the hammer. So Loki discovers that one of the giants of Jotunheim has stolen the hammer. I think it's Thrym, who's like the king of the giants. And so he hatches this plan to try and get it, because Thrym demands that he marries Freya, who's the most beautiful goddess. She wears like a coat of feathers, and a sort of golden coat of feathers and things like that. She's supposed to be very beautiful, and Thrym wants to marry her. So Loki and Thor go to Freya and go, will you marry the giant so Thor can get his hammers back? And she's like, no, obviously. Loki instead concocts this plan where Thor will dress up and borrow Freya's coat of feathers, and Thor, this big bulky man, a muscly man, will try to pretend to be Freya, wearing all of her clothes and a veil. So when they turn up to the giant's hall, wearing the veil and the dress and everything like that. First they have to do the wedding feast, so before they do the vows and things like that, and Frim won't release the hammer until the vows have been said. So they have this feast. I think the giants start to get a bit worried about Freya as Freya starts eating whole hogs of meat and whole barrels of ale and things like that, as Thor is just going, oh, I'm going to make the most of this feast, you know, while I'm here. And eventually it gets to doing the vows, and the hammer is presented, and Thor suddenly goes, I've got my hammer! And he goes off, and then he starts smashing all of the place up, and he kills loads of giants with his hammer. And that's one of the funniest sort of Norse myths that we like to tell.
Hi, would you like to say your name and share a myth or legend that you want to share with us today?
My name's Samantha Glasswell, and my dad told me when I was a little girl that when Richard III was riding out to Bosworth Field, he hit his spurs on Bow Bridge, and an old crone came out of the crowd and said, your head will hit the bridge on the way back. And as he was killed at the battle, when his body was brought back into Leicester, his head hit the bridge and they threw him into the river, and the monks at Abbey, at the St Mary in the Meadows at Abbey Park, pulled him out and buried his body. But we now know that that is a load of rubbish.
Perfect. Thank you so much. That's very insightful. And what have you enjoyed particularly about the festival today?
Seems to be an awful lot going on. I'm over in St Nicholas's Church, so I've not really seen very much, but I've been over to Jury Wall Museum. There's a lot going on over there as well, so it's just great to see so many people out and the sun shining for once.
Thank you so much.
Hi, what's your name, and do you have any myths or legends you'd like to share?
Hi, I'm Joe. I'm here dressed as a Roman federati from the 3rd century. Basically, I would talk about St. George and the dragon. So, contrary to what people often think, St. George was actually a Roman soldier. He was a cavalryman in the army. And the myth of the dragon comes about from St. George was martyred for his belief in Christianity. And Christians around the time of Diocletian, the emperor who killed lots and lots of Christians, believed that George would come back and fight Diocletian, and slay him for his persecution of the Christians. And murals that depicted St. George doing so often had him fighting Diocletian depicted as a giant serpent with a human face and labelled Drakos, meaning tyrant, hence George slaying the dragon Drakos. So that's where it comes from.
Well, that's really cool. And have you experienced the festival? And if so, is there anything that you particularly enjoyed?
So I've done this for about 3 years now, come to the festival. I enjoy just being dressed up as a Roman and talking to people about ancient Rome. But I also really, really enjoy seeing all the other reenactors around, like the Vikings and the English Civil War guys. It's always worth having a chat with them because they're an absolute font of knowledge about history.
Hi, what is your name? And do you have any myths or legends to share with me today?
Hiya, my name is Katie, and we are working on, with the Friends of Jury Wall, the legend of Sir George and the Dragon for St. George's Day that was 2 days ago. So we are creating beautiful dragons from the myth of St. George slaying the dragon, which originally came from Turkey in Cappadocia, and he was a saint in the 3rd or 4th century AD, I believe, moved to Libya and eventually became patron saint of England.
Perfect, thank you so much. And what have you enjoyed about the festival today?
It's been brilliant to see so many people dressed up. I got dressed up and I have a Roman hairstyle and Roman outfit. And I've been and visited my friends who are over at the Guildhall. And it's nice to see so many people out and celebrating history, heritage and culture.
Perfect, thank you so much for sharing.
What's your name, and do you have any myths and legends that you'd like to share?
Hi, I'm Essie. I'm part of the Mariners of Stronghold reenactment, and we're here on our ship, Brendan the Bold, which is named after Saint Brendan, the patron saint of sailors. Now, Brendan's story is that he was a monk living more or less in seclusion in Ireland, very quiet. And then one day a friend came to visit him and said this incredible thing had happened. If you sailed west from Ireland, you got to this special island that was the Isle of the Blessed. It was essentially heaven on earth. And it was just a rumour, but he really wanted to see if it was true. Is this something that Brendan could investigate? And Brendan was like, we don't know anything west of Ireland because it's just the Atlantic Ocean. Who even knows what's out there? But yeah, let's try it. So he made the framework of a curragh, which is sort of not a boat as grand as the one you're looking at now. It's a much more sort of humble thing, and put animal hides around the outside of it to make it watertight and tarred them. And then he and 12 friends set sail across the Atlantic. Well, I say 12 friends. Two guys who weren't part of the original party had decided to like invite themselves at the last minute. And as the voyage progresses, the myth goes through all of these different islands and the strange things that happen to them there. And one of the islands they get to has a palace. And inside this beautiful palace, the table is set for a sumptuous feast. And it's perfect timing because Brendan's boat is almost entirely out of supplies. But there's nobody there. They're calling and the entire place seems deserted. They're like, but the food's right there. And obviously they say a prayer of thanks afterwards, but they eat the food. And as they're leaving, Brendan walks through the doors of the palace just fine. His friends, one by one, walk out the doors of the palace just fine. And then on the threshold, two chaps who've invited themselves at the last minute and had apparently noticed that the cutlery, that the knives were solid silver, had decided, if I just slide one up my sleeve, no one's going to ever know. There's nobody living here, really. It turns out the palace was inhabited by invisible demons, and they get torn limb from limb at the top of the steps. So there's some quite brutal bits as they go through, but it's an incredible voyage. They go to so many places. They see an island that's made entirely of glass, these huge cliffs of glass on the distance. They see a place that they believe is the gates of hell, with flames spurting out of these like dark cliffs. And in the present day, people have connected those to icebergs in the North Atlantic and to the island of Iceland and the volcanic activity there. But Brendan's story is that he eventually made it all the way to the Island of the Blessed, a place where you never felt hunger or thirst or pain, where everything was perfect. And he could have stayed there forever, but he chose not to. He decided he would do the long and arduous journey all the way back to Europe just to let us know that this place existed. So Brendan's story is one of resilience and hope, the idea that there is something beautiful just beyond the horizon, and don't give up. That's the Brendan story.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was a really beautiful story.
That was a really good story, yeah.
Brendan is the patron saint of sailors. He was a monk in the Middle Ages who went on a voyage to find the Isles of the Blessed, because people believed that sort of you could sort of sail to heaven on earth, essentially. And there's a very long story of all his voyages as he went to various different islands, all of which had weird and magical creatures on. On Easter, they landed on an island where they were greeted by a lamb. People who have read the Chronicles of Narnia books might find bits of the story familiar because it was the inspiration for Voyage of the Dawn Treader, one of the Narnia children's books.
What century did Brendan live in?
So Brendan was in the Dark Ages, but he was very famous throughout the Middle Ages as a sort of saint that you would pray to, like on any kind of ship that was going through difficulties. He was your guy.
So explain the boat that you're in at the minute.
So our St. Brendan the Bold, is clinker built. You can tell that she's a slightly later vintage because she has a rudder rather than a steerboard, which is when you would just get one of these big oars that you can see here and hold it over the side to arrange and steer your sailing. I should be painting a picture because you've not got a camera. She has gorgeous rollocks for the oars to go through, carved like dragons. Her sail is currently furled, but she's got a lovely red sail up there. And she cuts a striking figure.
And you're here at Jubilee Square.
Absolutely, here at Jubilee Square for the Leicester Old Town Festival, which it's my first time visiting, but I'm loving it.
So please continue with any Anglo-Saxon stories.
Well, let me tell you the part about Brendan the Bold that doesn't show up in the Children's Narnia one, because there's a very scary section about two-thirds of the way through where Brendan and his fellow monks are sailing up against what appears to be the entrance to hell. So there's some cliffs, there's terrible waves coming up and up, and it's very difficult to steer. And as they get closer, the water gets hotter and hotter, and they can see there is a figure chained to these like cliffs, these jagged sort of basalt cliffs jutting out from the water. And it's the figure of Judas Iscariot, who's like every so often, this is him sort of on holiday from the bowels of hell. Like every so often, he can get chained to a cliff and have the waves come up against him, beating on him with this hot water. It's horrible, and that's his like little holiday from endless torment. So the whole story of the Brendan legend was designed to let people in the Middle Ages know this is what will happen to you if you're bad, but also you're going to eventually come to this beautiful island where there is no pain, where you have no need to eat or drink, but you can, where sort of all of the sort of bodily tragedies and woes of your sort of current existence will be a thing of the past and you can truly rest. And part of sort of the legend of Brendan is he did not rest there. He came back to tell everybody the good news and to tell them that there is something beautiful waiting for you. It's just over the horizon. Keep the faith.
Hello, Val.
Oh, hi, Helen. Oh, it's so good to be here. At least the sun is shining. And I am, as you know, from the Caribbean, Grenada in particular. In terms of my identity, I see myself as a black person living here in Leicester. Of course, we have had, when I was growing up, because I grew up in the Caribbean, we had sort of stories about Anansi, the Spider-Man. And he is a very, very clever person. It can either be a she or a he. It depends on who is telling the story. And he sort of does lots and lots and lots of tricks with various people. Children, parents would say to their children when we were growing up, behave yourself or else I'll get a Nancy to sort you out.
And can you tell me an Anansi story?
I really probably can't. I'm being very honest. I can't remember an Anansi story. I think it's more about what parents doesn't want their children to do. So they will be, for want of a better word, threatened with sort of Anansi coming and do something with them.
Yeah. My name's Bron. I'm a trader. And I deal in trading goods and exploration and navigation. But I also do a bit of research into various Viking myths and things.
Oh, well, we're very interested in some of your myths that you can tell us.
Yeah, depends what you want to know.
Do you have any that relate to Leicester at all?
Not particularly. Funnily enough, Leicester, there's not a lot of archaeological evidence around Leicester, despite the fact it was one of the big Viking centres. There's not been much found in or around Leicester. The Viking myths weren't really about corporeal places like on Earth. They were more mythology. Like, for instance, the gods all lived in Asgard, where Odin, Thor, Freya, Loki, they would have lived up in the heavens. And then below that, you've got Midgard, where humans lived. And below that, you've got Hela, where you went to hell. And then you also had Valhalla, where all of Viking warriors who died in battle went, and that was basically like a big mead hall where they just got drunk and ate a lot and chased the women around a lot. So that was their reward for dying in battle in Valhalla. So all the Vikings, that's why they were so fierce in battle, because they were quite happy dying. They were a bit like the Japanese kamikaze. They thought it was good dying because they went to Valhalla, because it was nicer up there.
Like the suicide bombers.
Yeah, basically, well, sort of. They weren't quite that bad, but they didn't have any fear, real fear of dying, because if they died in battle, that's what they wanted to do.
And they were so certain that this was correct.
Oh, yes, yes. Because the Vikings weren't actually a race of people. They were a culture from Sweden, Denmark, Norway, places like that. And they all had more or less the same values. They could speak the same sort of language. And they had a lot of the same mythology.
Do you know any more mythology?
Oh, you could go for hours and hours and hours. You had the Midgard serpent, who was the son of Loki, who was a mischievous god, a bit evil. He was always trying to get one of her on Thor. And the Midgard serpent was that big. It surrounded Midgard, and it circled Midgard and caused chaos, wars, famine, all sorts of trouble. And Thor used to come down from Asgard on his chariot, drawn by two huge horned goats, and his hammer, Mjolnir, and he used to fight the Midgard serpent. And up till now, he's defeated him because we've not died yet. And Viking mythology has it that if he doesn't defeat the serpent, you'll have what's called, and I've forgotten the name of it. No, it's got the end of the world, basically. So Thor's stopping the end of the world. But there's all sorts. I mean, Odin was one-eyed. He was the father god. He sat on his throne, and he was one-eyed because he actually took his eye out and gave it to a wisdom tree and to gain all the wisdom in the world. So he became the all-wise, all-father. He also had two ravens, Huginn and Muninn. He used to sit on his shoulders, and he used to send those around the world to find out things. So if you ever see two ravens watching you, you've got to be careful, because Odin's got his eye on you, literally. But there's all sorts of different... I mean, Odin's horse, Sleipnir, had eight legs and could move between worlds, basically. But to sort of... I mean, there are literally thousands of different mythology... Norse mythology. I can't think of any more off the top of my head, but no. It's that sort of thing.
And are these stories still told or not?
The problems with the Vikings is they've never written language, which makes it really awkward for us as a reenactment group, because we try and base everything on reality. The only thing they really had was runes, which were meanings and names. But they did have what's called the Icelandic sagas, which, because they sat around a fires at night, they didn't have really much else to do apart from the obvious. They tell long stories, so a lot of it was passed down word of mouth, and some of the stories are sort of a bit but some of it was actually written down. The medieval monks wrote down a lot about the Vikings, because they did really like the Vikings, because they got killed by them. They wrote a lot of stuff that wasn't very nice about the Vikings. But the Icelanders, who speak as near to Norse as you're ever going to get, they still have societies who pass down the sagas. And some of the sagas, I mean, there's like Beowulf, who fights a dragon. They can go on for 5, 6, 7 days. They go on and on and on. I sat and read one once. I got about half an hour into it and thought, okay, he killed the dragon at the end. That was it. I didn't need to be watching anything else.
So what interests you in doing this?
I started doing this because I was retiring and wanted something to do. And I've always been interested in mythology. Even when I was younger, I used to read about Aztecs and Egyptians. And I've always been a bit fascinated by the Vikings. And I looked these guys up and went along on the Wednesday night where we meet at St Mary's Hall in Braunston. So if anybody wants to come and join us, please do. We're always looking for new members. You don't have to be a combatter. You can do all sorts of things.
How do people get in touch with you?
We have a website, which is the Vikings of Middle England, at www.vikingsof.me, at Vikings Leicester. But if you just put Vikings of Middle England in Google, it'll show us. They show you what we do, where we've been. We do events like this. We are a historical reenactment, so we try and base everything on archaeological finds and what is actually real. Unlike some, they stretch the truth a little bit. The sort of Vikings go around with horns on their helmets, which they didn't do. Just, you know, cows over there.
Okay. Thank you ever so much.
That's okay.
Hi, would you like to state your name and how you're enjoying the festival today so far and what you've been up to?
Hi, I'm Kael Skulls. I'm Jarl of Tearsleaf, our Viking war band, and we've been camping out over here over in Jubilee Square, and we bought our Viking encampment, lots of different crafts going on, and we've also been doing a bit of fighting.
Perfect, thank you so much.
Hello, it's lovely to meet you here.
Hello, yes. Nice to be here.
And tell me what you're doing.
Well, we are Bill Brookman and Friend, the friend being Brian, and we are wandering musicians. We're wandering around committing acts of music.
Yes. And we're also wondering musicians, wondering what we're going to play next. But if we walk along and get too far away from each other, we do drift a little bit, so we have to stay together, you know, to stay on the beat.
And stay on the same tune sometimes.
And the same tune, yes, that's right.
And I told you that our theme for today was myths and legends. So do you have myths and legends, of your favourite ones? Or?
Oh, well, it's difficult as we are a legend, the pair of us.
Yes. Okay, so
And some of the things that have been said about us as being legendary are actually myths. We didn't commit those things.
What didn't you commit?
Oh, any of them. Honest, my lud. No, we've both been in show business more decades than either of us cares to remember, I think.
That's right, yes. And I've most of it.
You can't just pick out one or two things. I think the whole of our showbiz lives have been legendary and magical. And as we're getting towards the end of our careers, it's time to hand over for younger, newer people to take over, but not just yet. We're still available for bookings.
Yes.
So you were booked to come here?
Oh, yes. Yes.
Yes.
I'm trying to think what I know. I mean, there's the Humber Stone, isn't there? And then the other one that I know from Leicestershire is the one about the Bell the Giant.
Oh, brilliant.
And he does the leap, doesn't he? Because he's going to go...
He got on his sorrel horse at Mount Sorrel. Lots of things happen. The horse explodes, leaving one lip at one lip, things like that. And he ended up, Bell the Giant was buried at Belgrave, hence the name. But I can't remember very much more of that at all. But that's enough to spoil the story for anyone who sits down and reads it. But as for legends and myths around here, well, there's the Whipping Toms just round the corner, down by what I still think of as the Polytechnic, down by Newark Houses, where one day a year people were allowed to go out and whip people who didn't give them money.
I heard a very interesting thing on YouTube. And what it was a chap, a young chap, and he was saying that one of the reasons why he thought that a lot of myths are not common in England as opposed to being in loads in the west of the British Isles is because that the original Britons were driven out and they went off to Wales and took the myths with them. But there's evidence sometimes of their myths that they say relate back to somewhere in England because the place that it evolved was there and they took the story with them. You look like somebody who knows far more than I do on that, but that was an interesting idea.
Yes, no, I hadn't heard that one.
Mm.
No.
Yes.
I had heard the Bell the Giant one. Yes.
Yeah. There's certainly good evidence that things have travelled around and across the country in more modern times, sort of modern being this side of the Romans. And things like there are traditional dances and songs and tunes which are Cornish, but you only find them in three places across England. That's Cornwall, Derbyshire, and Lancashire. And the reason for that is, when they set up the mines in Derbyshire, they went to where you got the best miners, which was down in Cornwall. And they brought a load of them into Derbyshire. And they brought their own traditions with them. And then when they did the big burst in industry in Lancashire and Cheshire, they went for the nearest place with large groups of industrialised workers, and that was Derbyshire. And they again imported loads of people who took their own traditions, their own legends, their own myths with them. So you get recognisably similar tunes and dances in Cornwall, Derbyshire and Lancashire, which are not found in the gaps in between. You get different styles there. So that's sort of building on what Bill was saying of how things move and travel. If people get pushed out of places, they will take their own things with them, like their legends and their myths and their religions, for that matter. But if you physically move people not against their will into different places as a small group, they will spread their influence will spread. Let's put it that way.
Thank you. That's so fascinating.
Thank you.
Can you tell people how they could get in touch with you?
You just got to find us, really, if we're in the pub. We're retired, so we actually hide from people. We're not really looking for bookings because we're at heart we're lazy gits, and so if somebody drags us out and then we do it, we kind of perform. Is that right?
I think the phrase I use is not actively seeking work, but if work appears, I might take it.
Also, I mean, I've got a website, haven't I? And my name's Bill Brookman. So therefore, you'd kind of just Google Bill Brookman and you'll find me. There was another Bill Brookman in America, apparently, but he died. And so there's only one at the moment, unless another one's, come along.
The one and only.
Yes.
And I'm Brian Kingett, and I haven't got a website. Never needed one. I always got on through personal recommendations and repeat bookings.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.